So what I wanted to do was share just one or two thoughts that will fuel our prayer and our intercession. And if you want a text for tonight, it will be Luke 19 and verse 10. The Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. And just to take time to remind ourselves that lost people matter hugely to God. And therefore, as his children, lost people must matter hugely to us as well. Tonight is the last of our evening services before a summer break. I'm not sure we've done this before, to have a sort of couple of months summer break. We've certainly had a few Sundays when we haven't had evening services. We don't have one on the bank holiday. Usually we've had times when we've had a wedding on a Sunday afternoon instead of a normal evening service. When there's been a gathering down at New Wine and we've got 50 going, sometimes we've not had the service that Sunday evening. Sometimes there's been something small in the lounge. And next week's the World Cup final, and we rashly and stupidly thought that perhaps England might be involved and no one will come. And actually, this summer we've got all those things: a World Cup final, a Sunday wedding, Sundays at New Wine, a bank holiday. And we thought, gosh, how do we do our evenings? And as we were thinking about that, the Lord put at the same time onto our hearts the theme of hospitality, that he wants us to spend more time with those who are beyond the church, to spend time in relationship with them. And we felt those two things coming together. So people have said to me, are we cancelling the evening services for the summer for those practical reasons? And I say, partly. Or are we cancelling the evening services for the summer purely for hospitality reasons? I say, well, not entirely. But the process was those two things coming together. And we felt the Lord saying to us, just stop the evening services for a season over the summer. They'll start again in September the 5th. And if we're around over the summer, for most of those weeks, it's all age worship in the morning, so we don't have people out giving out to the children's groups, so they can be here with us as well. And this story of Zacchaeus is a wonderful introduction to our season of Sunday evening hospitality, if you like, because here is a story of Jesus eating a meal with someone whose life becomes changed as they encounter him. Now, there's no guarantees that on the Sunday evenings you spend time with friends maybe beyond the church, that the Lord will turn up and they will suddenly start giving their possessions away. You never know what will happen. But we do know that it's on the Lord's heart to spend time with those who are beyond the church, for the sake of relationship, for the sake of friendship, and our prayer that our relationship would be a bridge over which the Lord can walk to them and introduce himself to them. And so this story of Zacchaeus is one where Jesus deliberately went away from what he was doing to spend time relationally with Zacchaeus and just value him. Who knows whether Jesus knew what was going to happen? We know that Jesus said he only did what he saw the Father doing. And as he walks through Jericho, the Father points out Zacchaeus up the tree to him and tells Jesus his name. And so Jesus looks up, presumably inwardly praying, Father, what do you want me to do? And presumably the Father said, invite yourself to tea. Because Jesus says, come down, Zacchaeus, I want to come and eat at your house tonight. Now my prayer, and we'll be praying this together, is that over these couple of weeks, as we ask, well, Lord, who do you want us to spend time with? Particularly for those of us who are used to being here in the evening services, an extra evening a week is a glorious gift. There's some folks who Juliet and I find it very hard to find time with because our diaries don't coincide. And when we've managed to spend time, it may have been on Sunday afternoon just before I rush down to church. That's a gift to spend time with those people on one or two of the Sundays over the summer. And I pray that the Lord will put on your hearts people he would have you spend time with. Now, of course, it doesn't have to be on the Sunday evening. It may be you spend time with those close to you in order to spend time with others at another time. But just over this summer, we think God has led us to say, stop the evening service for a bit in order to give time to people beyond the church. And who knows what God will do with that. Now, just to fill out this theme of lost people mattering to God, would you flip back to Luke chapter 15, a very familiar chapter to many, though there may be one or two for whom these are new stories here tonight. In Luke chapter 15, we have three stories of lost and found. The first story is the story of the lost sheep. They're short stories, so I'll read a couple of them to you. Luke chapter 15 and verse 4. Jesus said, "Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbours together and says, 'Rejoice with me, I found my lost sheep.' I tell you that in the same way there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent." Well, here's just an interesting thought for us as we come to pray. There aren't quite 99 here tonight, I think. Probably more like 79, maybe 69, I don't know. That sort of number. And what we do, we pray, brings joy to the Lord. But Jesus said there's more joy in heaven when one sinner who repents than over a church full of 99 singing his worship. And we know how much the Lord loves the worship of his people. So actually it's an entirely appropriate thing that for a season we just lay to one side what we value on Sunday evenings, deliberately to give time praying that relationships where value will be built for their own sake. But obviously it's our prayer that the Lord will use those as well, that as we share something of us, something of what we believe in him, he would lead us to those who are ready for that. The lost coin is the second story. Verse 8. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins. This is probably the equivalent of an engagement ring or a wedding ring, a headdress with silver coins, perhaps given by a husband on a wedding day, and therefore of immense emotional value as well as monetary value. Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbours together and says, "Rejoice with me, I found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there's rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, the sheep get lost because they just wander away. They just go astray. So sheep do that. And there are people who are out of touch with God, not deliberately rebelling against him. They've just wandered off after the things that interest them. Whatever it is, car boot sales, Sunday morning football, the job, the mortgage, the family, the golf handicap, whatever it is, the cruise. They're not deliberately rejecting God, they just wandered after other things. The coin is lost through no fault of its own, presumably. It just happens to be in a position where it's not where it should be. And there are many people who are not in relationship with God. They haven't particularly done anything wrong. It's just perhaps they haven't had the privilege of ever hearing about him. Then there's this third story, the lost son. And I'm not going to read this one because I'm going to read Philip Yancey's paraphrase in a moment just to bring that fresh to us, to put it in a more contemporary language. But here's the story of a son who deliberately rebels against his father and goes to a far country. And there are those who are lost because they've deliberately turned their back on God and are seeking things elsewhere, deliberately saying no to God. Now, just a thought from my experience as we come to pray. Some people are prodigals. They've turned their back on God and they're away. If we chase after them, we probably drive them further away. What the father in this story does is wait for the son to come home. And when he sees him coming home, there's a big welcome and a big party. He no doubt prays for him, he looks. But if you chase a prodigal, you probably chase them further away. Then there are lost sheep, who unless you go after them, they're not coming back. They're lost. They've no idea of the route home. They don't have an inbuilt sat-nav. They're just not going to find their way home unless you go after them. And one of the mistakes I've made in my ministry is chasing prodigals rather than patiently praying for them and waiting. And patiently waiting and praying for lost sheep when actually you need to go after them. And in the prayers, I want to lead in a time of prayer for God to put into your mind one or two people, maybe some who are prodigal, who've rejected the Lord for the time being, who he just wants you to pray for. Not to go chase them. It may be relationship with them, friendship, but not chasing them spiritually, not laying anything heavy on them, just pray. And to put into your mind those who may be lost sheep, those who are out there who are just waiting for an invitation to come and see, come to church, come to Alpha, come to Just 10 in the autumn, come to whatever it is. For the Lord to put these people on our minds. We don't know what the Lord's going to do, but just as Jesus only did what he saw the Father doing, So that's what we're called to do. And I pray that there will be great joy in the summer season of hospitality. And I pray also that that will put into us a constant way of operating. Lord, who do you want us to spend time with? Just as we had a month in June thinking about God setting us free from strongholds, and it's put something into us as a church. What's God trying to release me from at the moment, and how do I cooperate with that? So for this season, Lord, who do you want me to spend time with? So that we don't just spend time with those we whine, you know, who shout loudest at our diaries, but we spend time with those God is calling us to spend time with. So we're going to pray about those things. Before we do that, I'm going to read this Yancey version of the story, which I always find pulls at the heartstrings and just brings it up to date for me. And then the band are going to play a song called Come Home Running. So we'll have the band come and get ready. The words to the song when it comes will go on the screens, but the idea is that we stay sitting or kneeling in prayer and they play the song to fuel our meditation. So here's the story. And after the story, there's a song. And after the song, there's some prayer. A young girl grows up on a cherry orchard just above Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents are a bit old-fashioned and tend to overreact to her nose ring, the music she listens to, and the length of her skirts. They ground her a few times and she seethes inside. "I hate you," she screams at her father when he knocks on the door of a room after an argument. And that night she acts on a plan she's mentally rehearsed scores of times. She runs away. She's visited Detroit only once before on a bus trip with her church youth group to watch the Tigers play. Because newspapers in Traverse City report in lurid detail the gangs, the drugs, and the violence in downtown Detroit, she concludes it's probably the last place her parents will look for her. California, maybe, Florida, perhaps, not Detroit. On her second day in Detroit, she meets a man who drives the biggest car she's ever seen. He offers her a ride, buys her lunch, arranges a place for her to stay. He gives her some pills that make her feel better than she's ever felt before. She was right all along, she decides. Her parents were keeping her from all the fun. The good life continues for a month, 2 months, a year. The man with the big car, she calls him boss, teaches her a few things that men like. Since she's underage, men pay a premium for her. She lives in a penthouse and orders room service whenever she wants. Occasionally she thinks about the folks back home, but their lives now seem so boring and provincial she can hardly believe she grew up there. She has a brief scare when she sees her picture printed on the back of a milk carton with the headline, "Have you seen this child?" But by now she has blonde hair, and with all the makeup and body-piercing jewellery she wears, no one would mistake her for a child. Besides, most of her friends are runaways, and nobody squeals in Detroit. After a year, the first sallow signs of illness appear, and it amazes her how fast the boss turns mean. "These days we can't mess around," he growls, and before she knows it, she's out on the street without a penny to her name. She still turns a couple of tricks a night, but they don't pay much, and all the money goes to support her habit. When winter blows in, she finds herself sleeping on metal grates outside the big department stores. Sleeping is the wrong word. A teenage girl at night in downtown Detroit can never relax her guard. Dark bands circle her eyes. Her cough worsens. One night, as she lies awake listening for footsteps, all of a sudden everything about her life looks different. She no longer feels like a woman of the world. She feels like a little girl, lost in a cold and frightening city. She begins to whimper. Her pockets are empty and she's hungry. She needs a fix. She pulls her legs tight underneath her and shivers under the newspapers she's piled on top of her coat. Something jolts a flash of memory and a single image fills her mind. Of May in Traverse City, when a million cherry trees bloom at once, with her golden retriever dashing through rows of blossomy trees chasing a tennis ball. "God, why did I leave?" she says to herself, and pain stabs at her heart. "My dog back home eats better than I do now." She's sobbing, and she knows in a flash that more than anything else, she wants to go home. Three straight phone calls, three straight connections with the answering machine. She hangs up without leaving a message the first two times, but the third time she says, "Dad, Mum, it's me. I was wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way, and it'll get there about midnight tomorrow. if you're not there, well, I guess I'll just stay on the bus till it hits Canada. It takes about 7 hours for a bus to make all the stops between Detroit and Traverse City, and during that time, she realizes all the flaws in her plan. What if her parents are out of town and miss the message? Shouldn't she have waited another day or so till she could talk to them? And even if they are home, they probably wrote her off as dead long ago. She should have given them some time to get over the shock. Her thoughts bounce backwards and forwards between these worries and the speech she's preparing for her father. Dad, I'm sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault, it's mine. Dad, can you ever forgive me? She says the words over and over, her throat tightening even as she rehearses them. She hasn't apologized to anybody in years. The bus has been driving with lights on since Bay City. Tiny snowflakes hit the pavement, rubbed warm by thousands of tires, and the asphalt steams. She's forgotten how dark it gets at night out here. A deer darts across the road and the bus swerves, every so often a billboard, a sign posting the mileage to Traverse City. Oh God. When the bus finally rolls into the station, its air brakes hissing in protest, the driver announces in a crackly voice over the microphone, 15 minutes, folks, that's all we have here. 15 minutes to decide her life. She checks herself in her compact mirror, smooths her hair and licks the lipstick off her teeth. She looks at the tobacco stains on her fingertips and wonders if her parents will notice, if they're there. She walks into the terminal not knowing what to expect. Not one of the thousand scenes that had played out in her mind prepare her for what she sees. There in the concrete walls and plastic chairs bus terminal in Traverse City, Michigan, stands a group of 40 brothers and sisters and great aunts and uncles and cousins and a grandmother and great grandmother to boot. They're all wearing goofy party hats and blowing noisemakers, and taped across the entire wall of the terminal is a computer-generated banner that reads, "Welcome home." Out of the crowd of well-wishers breaks her dad. She stares out through the tears quivering in her eyes and begins her memorized speech. "Dad, I'm sorry. I know." He interrupts her. "Child, we've no time for that. No time for apologies. You'll be late for the party. A banquet's waiting for you at home."